www.own-it.org. Own It provides a free intellectual property service for the creative industries. And now with the Own It podcast series, anyone, no matter of location, can gain an insight into IP. The writer, producer, director triangle, a guide to good practice of collaboration in the theatre. This cinema will help you avoid the pitfalls and future disputes by guiding you through certain rules and legal framework for collaboration in the theatre. Speakers are Harry Carolou, lawyer, Annette Mees, director, Emma Taylor, actor, director, producer, Stephen Keyworth, writer for television, and Louise Harris, producer. This event took place at the London College of Fashion on the 24th of the 9th, 2008. This is the first part of a two-part podcast.
My name's Harry Carolou. I'm a solicitor specialising in intellectual property. I'm from the law firm Lawrence Graham, or LG, as they have recently rebranded. And what I'm going to do is very briefly just run through the main issues of copyright in relation to the theatre. And then I'll introduce each of our speakers, who will then give a short presentation particular to their roles. After each presentation, then we'll have a short discussion about some of the issues that they've raised. So I'll kick off then by a brief overview of what I'm going to talk about today. So what rights are there, who owns them, and what happens when things go wrong? So the main right that we're talking about here is copyright. And copyright can arise in many different ways, and there's many different forms of copyright. And each form of copyright has its distinct rules. But in relation to the theatre, there's three main types of copyright that I wanted to briefly mention. The first is literary copyright, and that would subsist in the script. You can have dramatic copyright, and that will be in the performance. And finally, if there is any music involved, then there will obviously be musical copyright in that as well. In relation to the last two, however, they will only exist once they're recorded. So if you were to put on a production now, and no one was to record it, and it was to happen once and once only, there was no record of that, there would be no copyright in that. So for there to be dramatic copyright and musical copyright, it has to be recorded. The reason for that is that for copyright to subsist, it has to be in a permanent form. So in most cases, that will be written. But for things like dramatic and musical copyright, it can only happen if it's been recorded. Okay, so obviously here we're talking about the different roles played by the directors, the writers and the producers. Often what happens is that there's a collaboration between different people and each person is providing different things. A question that's often asked is who owns what? Well, there's two ways of looking at this first. Firstly, if each person is providing something that is distinct, then they will own the copyright in that particular part. However, if it's all a part of a whole, if it's a collective, and it's not clear exactly who contributed to what, then you have a situation of joint ownership, as set out in the Copyright Designs and Patents Act, and I've got the relevant section up there. Now, for there to be joint ownership of copyright, each contribution needs to be indistinguishable. So you cannot tell who did what. Okay. Now, it doesn't have to be completely equal ownership. So just because someone's only added something, a smaller part than someone else, that's absolutely fine. You can still have joint ownership there. The key thing is whether you can tell who contributed to what. The contributions must be to the actual creation of the work. So, for instance, if you're writing a script and you ask someone to proofread it, yes, it's a very valuable service that they're providing, but they're not providing anything creative, so therefore they will have no copyright, even if they make some minor amends to the script. So who owns what? Well, so there's different types of copyright. It's actually possible for there to be different layers of copyright in one piece of work and for a different person to own each. So for instance, it's possible for in one piece of work for the author to own the literary copyright in the script, the composer, if there's music, to own the musical copyright in the score, and then the director and or the producer to own the dramatic copyright once it's been recorded. So this can be one production. And there will be three different people owning different layers of copyright. So one of the real problems you have in those situations is what happens if there's a disagreement often occurs, happens far more regularly than you may think. And I'm sure it's probably occurred to some people here tonight. The most often problem that occurs is where there is joint authorship and it's not clear who owns what, or where there's overlapping rights and people aren't clear as to what they own. For there to be copyright infringement, there must be a copying, hence the term copyright, of a substantial portion of the work. Substantial can either be on a quantitative basis or a qualitative basis. So quantitative, if they take the majority of the work, that will be infringement. Qualitative, if they take the best parts of the work, that would also be infringement. But these are subjective tests. So there's no rule. You often hear people ask, if I change something 7 times or if I change something, by a certain percentage or whatever, it doesn't mean anything. It's a subjective test and it's done on a case-by-case basis. Now, I know that's not particularly helpful for people who want to have some a definite rule, but that's where we are. It's quite a flexible test as well. I thought it may be useful if I just mentioned a case that was recently decided. Hopefully there's no one here who was involved. But the names of the parties were Obisanya against Ellis. Obisanya was an author and Ellis was a production company. And the author had written a script for a film, a screenplay. And then the production company decided to make some films based on the screenplay. Now, I say based on the screenplay. What there was a common setting, and they shared the same genre. Now, this case hasn't been reported fully yet, so there isn't the detail there, so we can't really find out exactly what happened. But what we know is that there was a common setting and the same genre, which was romantic comedy. Author claimed copyright infringement because the production company didn't involve the author in the films. So they went off, made the films, made lots of money. Perhaps they didn't, but anyway. And the author complained. Production company countersued and asked for an injunction to stop the author claiming that they had copied the work. The court found in favour of the production company and held that the chronology of events went against the author and it showed that there had been no copying. And just because there were some similarities, that was all due to the common setting and no more. So no infringement. You may think that's quite surprising. Now, as I said, I don't know what the actual what the films were or what the script was like, so we can't actually test to see how similar they were. But the key thing there is that there was a dispute, the parties fell out, and they ended up in court. So what can you do to try and prevent that from happening? Well, in an ideal world, and I would say this, you'd go and see some lawyers first, and you get an agreement drawn up. And the agreement would clearly say who owns what, and if there is to be any exploitation of the work, how any profits arising from that will be distributed. So it's clear, it's black and white, and there could be no room for disputes. I mean, obviously, that is a perfect world, and that isn't always going to happen, in which case you then go to the fallback position of what the Act says. And as we've said, the Act allows for things like joint ownership, and it allows for overlapping rights, which unfortunately can lead to disputes. Okay, so that was a very brief and swift overview of the relevant law in the area. I'm now going to hand you over, and hopefully I've got the order right, to Emma. And Emma is an actor, director and a producer.
I'm the producer of a show called News Review. Some of you may have seen it. It's been running for 29 years. We celebrate its 30th anniversary next year. And we actually have the Guinness World Record for being the world's longest running live comedy show. I've been with the show for about 8 years, and I work with a team of about 100 writers. So we not often get into disputes, but there are areas where sometimes we do need professional advice. Last year, we were in a very fortunate position. We were approached by a company based in New York who actually wanted to franchise News Review. So we were looking at creating News Review New York. And because we had had our fingers burnt in the past, we have had people who have tried to, as it were, rip off the brand. I won't mention names, but we decided that we needed to go and see lawyers and get proper agreements drawn up, as Harry was just suggesting.
Okay, so I think we're going to next move on to Annette. Annette is a director.
I was invited today to come in as a director, mostly because my work is extremely collaborative. Lots of my the work that I do works with process and tries to get as many different people in the room with as many different expertises. Therefore, sort of copyright becomes a really blurry, blurry subject. Who has the IP, and is the IP, does it lie with originators or with groups? How far can you split, really, takings of a show? We all know how little money there is. If there's 17 people who have all been involved in some level, how does one deal with that? The other thing that I do is I work a lot with R&D periods and semi-public workshops to develop work, which is a way to get from ideas to something more formed and something more formal that one can work with on a contractual, more regular basis. IP again becomes very blurry there, because I will take ideas from those workshops, but also people visit those workshops, they create work, how do we negotiate what they can take away, what I can keep from them, and how do you do that in a way that's productive for both parties? And I think the last thing that I'm really interested in is originators. I've been working, a producer I've worked with has asked me to work on an idea he had, which is sort of almost a format. I got a writer involved. It's going quite nicely. We've left it for a little bit because we all got too busy. Currently, my producer has gone into television. Bless him. Lots of money. But the original idea was his. Now, I've worked with the writer further. How do we negotiate that IP? What is an originating idea? If it's a kernel, what is that worth? Is that worth anything? And how do you do that in a kind way, I think? So far, I've always worked with as much transparency as possible. I think that's important. And I've used Creative Commons, which is basically just a shortcut. If you don't want to go via the lawyer. So for me, that's an interest. Oh, and the last thing, actually, which I wrote down while I was listening to you, is I think many people that work more experimentally or more collaboratively don't necessarily end up with a prompt script, which was the director's, hey-ho, this is my show. Especially if you don't block very strongly, if there's lots of open, fluid sections in the work that change per night. How do I come to, as you say, a record of what my input has been?
Thank you. Okay. Just to pick up then, I think on a couple of points there, Annette. The first thing I think is this whole workshop sharing of ideas, which is a common thing. But I go back to one of the things I said in my brief introduction is that for there to be copyright, it has to be in a permanent form. So we here today, we can sit here and we can share ideas, and then one person can go out and actually produce something. Only that one person will have any copyright, and that's in what they produced. The fact that I contributed by sharing some ideas means absolutely nothing as far as copyright is concerned. So it's only in the written permanent form that there can be copyright. But it's something that often happens, especially with particularly workshops and collaborations. How can you deal with that? Well, I think you need to make clear to the people who are attending the collaborations that it is a sharing of ideas, and that one or more people will be taking those ideas away and creating something. And if they don't want that to happen, then perhaps they shouldn't be attending or contributing to the ideas, because it has to. I think as you say, transparency is important. So it's better for that to be clear and out in the open before the sharing of ideas happens. Just in relation to the final point, very difficult actually, where the actual event is changing, it's been improvised. But as I said, the actual performance doesn't itself attract copyright. There's something separate called performers' rights which will be owned by the individual actors. But as far as copyright concerned, there can be no copyright unless it's recorded. So if the event is changing constantly, for there to be copyright in each different iteration, you'd have to record each one. And that's the only way you can have copyright in each different variation. If you only have copyright in the initial thing, and then by the time the run's finished, it's something completely different, you would have no copyright in that final version of the event unless you recorded that one as well. Okay, so if we move on then to Stephen, and Stephen is a writer.
Hello. Hi. Yeah, I'm a writer, you can tell, because I've got a tiny bit of card and they've got a book and a printout. So I'm just slightly more shambolic. I started working mainly in theatre, and I've done all kinds of work over the years. I've been commissioned by theatres. I studied drama in Manchester, and I worked at the Royal Exchange for two plays, and I've also done my own very, very unprofitable shows on the fringe. Just today I found out a show I did last year is still losing money. just when you think it's all over. And I've more recently also jumped into the world of television, and I was on the Writers Academy, and I'm sort of writing for EastEnders and Casualty and Holby. This year, I had the experience of being slightly fired from Holby and then having somebody come in and rewrite my script. They did it very nicely, actually, and they didn't keep anything of mine at all, which I think is the preferred way, because you create characters and you think, oh, I hope he doesn't make them do the wrong things, but he basically burnt the ground and there was nothing left. Very heartwarming. I'm starting again there next week. So, I've done all kinds of collaborations over the years. Most recently, I've been writing the book for a musical for Youth Music Theatre UK, which is a new kind of collaboration for me with a composer. I'm interested in. I was shown a contract which split the rights for a musical three ways between composer, lyricist, and the book writer. And me and the composer are coming into some sort of, I don't know, I think we worked in quite a different way. So we're at the moment we get on fine, so we haven't put anything on paper. So I guess we're looking to find a way of sort of defining this. Should it go any further? The other project I've been working on recently, which I think is interesting as far as copyright goes, is last year I did a play which was based on a living person. It was written for a particular performer, and I had sort of 6 hours of conversation with him, and then sort of wrote a show based on that. And then, because his life was so extraordinary, I then had to create other equally extraordinary stuff to sort of match it and just blur the line between truth and reality. And I guess I'm interested. It's not the first time I've done that. It's an area I'm interested in. So, as I promised, shambolic. And I've worked for theatres on the fringe, and I was writer in residence for a portable elevator for a while, working in site-specific half-hour plays inside a touring portable elevator, and now television, radio. So I can sort of answer questions when we get to the Q&A bit of all kinds of areas, I guess. And the last one I'll chuck in is on the branding issue. I did write a play a few years ago called George Orwell's 1984 School Disco. And I was threatened with legal action by the School Disco nightclub chain, who have copyrighted the word School Disco in all entertainment. And even my agent can sort that one out, which is, I don't know if Harry has any opinions on that one, but I've left that behind. But it's, bring it up. Anyway, that's my bit for now.
Okay, thanks, Stephen. I think you've thrown me there. I was all prepared until you mentioned George Orwell's 1984 School Disco. But let's go back to the thing you said before then about a well-known living person, and you creating a story based on their life even. What you need to be, you're absolutely right, the copyright will be in the written form, so it's whatever you produce. Just because you based it on a living person doesn't mean that they have any copyright in what you create, even though it's their life. But what you need to make sure is that you have their consent as to using their name and or likeness, if that's appropriate, if you're going to use images of them, and make sure that that you have their consent for all the purposes that you have in mind. So they know, for instance, that, you know, this isn't just going to be a book, you're actually going to make a stage production or a film or whatever, and that they consent to that. Otherwise, they could try and prevent you from using their name and associating their name with whatever you're doing. So that's the first thing there. The second thing, on the trademark threatening letter received from the lawyers, it doesn't surprise me, although I thought you were going to say that you'd received something from the estate of George Orwell rather than from School Disco. Yeah. But yes, I mean, that would be, without knowing any facts, that would be what I would assume to be a case of trademark infringement, because yes, School Disco would be a registered trademark. Well, I assume so, and that you were using their trademark and perhaps suggesting that there was some form of association with them. Arguable. If you ever receive a threatening letter and you disagree with its content, there is something in the Trademarks Act and in some of the other acts, I think it's section 23, but I may be wrong, which is all related to groundless threats. So if you think that someone is making a groundless threat of infringement against you, you can actually countersue them and go to court, and assuming you're correct, and the court will grant an injunction preventing them from making any further threats. They would also have to pay your legal costs, and you may even actually conflict their lawyers from working for them as well. So it's a pretty, you know, disruptive thing to be able to do to someone if you think they are making groundless threats. But you have to be obviously you have to feel confident in your case, and it wouldn't be, it's not something that I would suggest you do without taking legal advice first, because if you get it wrong, then you're going to end up paying their costs, which chances are will be quite hefty. But okay, all right, that was just quickly sidetracked there. I think what I was proposing to do next, and I think each of our speakers had some questions that they wanted to address. If they've been answered already, fantastic. But if they haven't, I thought we'll deal with those first, before we then move on to the general question and answer session.
And in essence, I've asked most of my question in the introduction, but I'd really like to come back to originating ideas, because yeah. I think that's something that continuously props up. Yeah. And the other thing I'd really like to talk a little bit more about is that something on paper, what that is. How do I put something on paper to protect myself? Is an email to you enough? Or if I do create something fluid, can I put the framework that I give my actors on paper? Is that something? And how do I make that from my notebook to a document that means something?
Yeah. Okay, so in terms of originating ideas, this is, as I said, a problem that often arises. And I think one of the things, if we look at it from the perspective of the person who is contributing the idea, okay, if they are concerned that their idea is going to be used in a manner they're not happy with, then I think the thing that you need to possibly try and enter into is what we call a confidentiality or non-disclosure agreement. What that does is that controls how your idea will be used. You know, you can say, yes, we will have a meeting. At this meeting, we will discuss different ideas. These ideas will be confidential. I will not use your ideas without your consent. You will not use my ideas without my consent. And then, you know, assuming that the other side is happy to sign that, then you have something, you have some form of protection, which if they then go away and end up using your ideas without your consent, you can take action over for breach of the confidentiality agreement. The problem is, and that's all fine if you're dealing with equals. The problem is, if you want to, for instance, submit an idea to a production company or to a studio, whoever, they will often not sign non-disclosure confidentiality agreements. And that's not there's nothing devious about that necessarily. There might be in some cases, but the reason is that they will receive so many contributions and ideas that if they were to sign confidentiality agreements for each and every one, they would actually prevent themselves from doing anything. because they would have to go and obtain consent for each time they wanted to do something. So that's the main reason why a large organisation may be reluctant to sign such an agreement. In that case, unfortunately, what you're left is a decision, commercial risk, and you need to weigh that up. What's the potential benefit from me giving my idea to someone, and the potential downside? And if you decide that without contributing your idea, there's no way you're going to get any benefit, you may think, well, it's better than nothing, so I will try and see what happens. I know it's not an ideal position to be in, but unfortunately, in some cases, you're left in a difficult position where you have to decide whether you want to go ahead and contribute your ideas without any protection. What do we mean by in writing, or as the act says, in a permanent form? It can be absolutely anything. An email to me is absolutely fine. The one I often hear is, can I send a stamped address envelope to myself, and that remains sealed? Fine as well. Don't have to do that, but that is just one example. Basically, anything that's writing, it's written. The key thing, and the main reason for doing this, is actually to prove two things: authorship and the date of creation. They're the two key things that you want to be able to prove. If you are to try to sue someone for copyright infringement, one of the first things you'll probably get in a defence is, well, actually, you don't own the copyright in this. If you do, prove it. How on earth do you go about proving that you own the copyright in something? Well, if you've written a script, chances are you've gone through various drafts before you've got to the final version. If you can show to someone, well, actually, here are 10 drafts with all my markups, my amendments, my track changes, however you work, that's pretty good evidence. Chances are the person that's copied you is not going to have 10 drafts. They're going to have one version which they basically copied from you. So that's evidence to show that you are the author of that work. The date is also important because copyright only subsists for a certain amount of time. It's actually a long time in most cases. It's actually 70 years from the date of death of the author. So it's a very long period in time. But, for instance, it's important to know, for instance, where you want to perhaps rely on some classic literature, for instance. If that's out of copyright, then you're absolutely free to use that without any concern. Just make sure there are no trademark issues with the name, if there's any names in there of the authors. But other than that, from a copyright perspective, there's no problem there. It's also fine to have it recorded as a file on your PC, laptop, whatever. That, you know, it doesn't have to be kind of printed out. That's still a record of your creation, and that's absolutely fine as well.
That's the end of part one of this Own It podcast.